Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Conscious Vibe Podcast,
where we elevate intellect through conscious dialogue
while exploring race, politics, business, and culture.
I'm Dr. Daryl L. Jones.
And I'm Charles D. Mitchell. DJ?
My man.
You know, I said this earlier. We don't have to sit here and go, man, I hadn't seen you in like 3 weeks.
Is this true?
No, it's good. We had dinner 2 nights ago with our esteemed guest here, Mr. Eric Moses. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome, my man.
All I had to do is show up to become esteemed. I like it. I like the way this works.
And he's a Kappa man.
Yeah, he's a Kappa man. Not only is he a Kappa man, this is someone I've known since I was in graduate school, University of North Carolina. Eric was in undergraduate school. We met when he was actually pledging Kappa Alpha Psi.
Wow.
So it's been a long time, long stand. Yeah, well, we won't get too deep into that, how we met, perhaps what position you were in.
It was not a meeting of equals. So let me tell you that. It's not a meeting of equals.
But no, we've kept in touch over the years. And, you know, actually it was a stint when I was in law school. After he graduated from law school, we had a stint when I was in D.C. And fortunate enough to get back into touch in the last year. And the bigger piece is, you know, Eric's had a long career now in sports. Most recently, I don't know if I should say currently or most recently, but
both
Nashville, president of Nashville International Raceway. But as of this week, I think Tuesday official, or is it official in a few weeks?
It's official on December 1st.
The announcement was made Tuesday. This
yeah.
week.
Yeah.
That Eric Moses is the new executive director and CEO. Chief Executive Officer, for those of us who don't know, of Fiesta Bowl.
Congratulations, man.
Congratulations.
That's awesome.
And then welcome again to the Conscious Vibe.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
So, Eric, let's do this. Let's give everyone a little bit of background, where you were raised, and just give us a little bit of that sort of history. What led you up into your first opportunity to work in sports, so we can go through that.
Sure. So grew up in Central New Jersey, Exit 9, Turnpike, not Parkway.
What city?
For those who know. Somerset, right near Rutgers.
We had this conversation. I lived in Somerset.
Yeah,
exactly. We had this conversation.
You lived in Franklin Greens?
Absolutely.
Yeah, which was literally, I could walk there from my house.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So grew up there, left Jersey after my junior year of high school to move to Greensboro, North Carolina, and live with my grandmother so I could get in-state residency to go to the only university I applied to and the only one I ever wanted to go to, which is the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You might know us as the University of National Champions.
He said it, folks. He said it.
I did say it. We'll stick by it. And then went to Duke while I was at, for law school. While I was at Carolina, had the good fortune of being with folks and befriending folks, men and women, who were talented enough to make money off of their athletic talents, you know, at the next level. And I remember thinking, I knew I was going to go to law school, but I remember thinking, these folks have unique opportunities to leverage their unique skills to make outsized returns and revenue for themselves and maybe generational kind of wealth for their families, but they get taken advantage of. Like, you know, we've all heard the horror stories about athletes being ripped off by unscrupulous agents, advisors, accountants, mm-hmm. whomever. I wanted to protect my friends, right? So I went to law school thinking I was going to be an agent. Drew Rosenhaus, probably the most successful NFL agent of all time, went to Duke, represented his first client. I don't even know if you knew this, represented his first client as a 2L at Duke, Robert Bailey, who was a cornerback from North Carolina Central.
No way.
He literally went right down the street.
And I know Robert Bailey. My sister went to Central. My mom and dad do it.
Played for Detroit.
Yeah. Totally know.
Yeah. So Drew, that was Drew's first, I think, as an agent himself. I think he worked for an agency kind of before law school down in Florida. But that was his first client. So I'd heard those stories and I'm thinking, well, if he could do it, you know, I went to school with these guys. Mm-hmm. Let me do that. Had the very good fortune of being able to sit in on Grant Hill's interview of prospective agents. With his parents were fantastic people. Mother just passed, God rest her soul.
She was a
wonderful woman.
Sorry,
yeah, within the last probably 2 months. Mm. And let me and one of my classmates sit in on his agent selection interviews. And so I kind of got to see firsthand what that interplay was like, and talked to some of the agents after. And it dawned on me pretty quickly that it didn't comport with my idea of being a professional to chase 21 and 22-year-old kids around the country to get them to sign with me so I could pay my law school loans. That was not the way I wanted to get things started. So try to figure out, well, how do I get into entertainment or sports more broadly defined? And as Charles knows, and that's what we came back together, went to D.C. to work for a communications law firm. You know, it was buying and selling TV and radio stations back after, I feel old saying this, but the 1996 Telecommunications Act passed.
Remember the MCI building in D.C.?
Indeed, indeed. The MCI Center, right? Right. Which became the Verizon Right. Center.
And who is MCI now?
Yeah. So that's how I got my career started. Did not really move into sports specifically until 2008. When the mayor of Washington, D.C. asked me to be the CEO of the D.C. Sports Commission, Sports Entertainment Commission, and have bounced around a little bit since then.
Yeah, awesome.
Well done. Oh, wow. Well done.
So going back, man, what was it like? I want to go back to childhood a little bit. How would you describe growing up in Central Jersey? What stands out for you?
I have to always juxtapose it to the time that I spent in the South, right? Like, I think of myself as a son of the South, you know, born in Greensboro, finished high school there, college, law school, spent 8 years there. But I'm glad I grew up in Jersey.
Yeah.
Like, there's a little bit of an edge that folks in the Northeast have, and I don't mean this in any kind of, like, you know, super biased way or anything like that. I'm a little biased because that's where I grew up. But, you know, you question things a little more. You know, you kind of wait a little bit for people to prove themselves or what have you. So I think that awareness or that reticence to kind of just immediately trust people, immediately give people the benefit of the doubt is something that has served me well and also aligns well with being a lawyer, right? When your job is to identify and mitigate risk, right? So to be on the lookout for it so you can tell your clients and inform them or what have you. So I think I enjoyed that part of it. I enjoyed being kind of urban adjacent, right? We lived in a suburb in New Jersey, but we were equidistant from New York and Philadelphia. Like I could, you know, get hung out a lot as a kid in New York City. And I think that benefited me. Also happy to have spent a lot of time in the South because I like when people say, hey. You know what I mean? I don't want to necessarily have my guard all the way up every time I meet somebody. I like the fact that folks want to build relationships and not engage in such transactional kind of dealings with each other. And so, I like that mix of North and South that went into kind of my upbringing.
I've never heard it described that way, though. But that's a really unique way to describe it. But it really is.
I've never thought of it either. And I think it's really important that you were able to take the two and find value in both in terms of how you maneuver in the world. And obviously it's benefited you tremendously. And, you know, I think about that too, because I know growing up in the South, which you can probably vouch for, growing up in North Carolina, you know, you're obviously much more trusting in terms of just the people that are around you. It wasn't this environment where you felt like you had to have your, you know, head on a swivel all the time. You know, it was more of like, aside from the, you know, the obvious things around, you know, race and culture, which is just part of the deal, right?
Right.
And even where I grew up, and I would suggest the same thing about Greensboro, given that I went to undergraduate school there, you know, it wasn't this notion that it was always in your face, right? It was just, you know, it was the South. You grew up with, you know, Black people, white people, and sure there were some differences there, but it wasn't a part of like this huge identity piece, and you had to always sort of like be.
It wasn't like it was for our parents.
Like it was for our parents. We have to be reticent all the time about what someone's motives are. So you grew up a little more trusting than perhaps was in your best interest to be, you know. And so I think about that sometimes too. I had to find out the hard way going into careers. That, wait a minute, this is a little bit more dog-eat-dog than I could have imagined, and the environment is a lot more competitive, and you have to be able to maneuver and navigate and be wary of what people's real motives are and learn that way. And that's an early lesson that, you know, I think you picked up that certainly took me years to sort of, like, put into, like, how I wove myself into the fabric of anything.
I think Jersey's underrated as far as what you just described. Mm-hmm. That dynamic, mm-hmm. I don't think not a lot of people, even when you ask a direct question, articulate it around that. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it, there's also sort of a validation that comes with growing up, I think, mm-hmm. in Jersey. It's that where you from? Jersey, yeah, but where?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, Newark.
Yeah, Brick City.
All right. Yeah. All right, man. Yeah. New Brunswick. Yeah. Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Got you. Mm-hmm. Bayonne. You know, that's where Dana was from. And I lived in Jersey as a kid, Teaneck and Englewood.
Oh yeah.
Formative years in Atlanta, but all my summers in Michigan.
Okay.
So that dynamic you're describing.
You got the Midwest thing,
I got all that too, man.
Right. That's useful.
7th through 12th was Michigan.
Yeah.
But some of that Teaneck, Yonkers, Englewood stuff in there too, mm-hmm. early. Yep. So I tasted that. And then Atlanta in some critical years. To me, Jersey's underrated. You don't hear great things about New Jersey. Yeah. But anybody I know who's grown up there, I got a lot of my boys are from Jersey and have spent time in Jersey. And I value their friendships quite a bit. There's something about the edge and confidence. But they're just cool. They're just cool brothers at the end of the day.
I felt like when I first got to North Carolina for my senior year of high school, I felt like that edge was like a superpower. Like I felt like I could see things that other people couldn't see. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and when when we were growing up and as teenagers, you're hanging out and sometimes stuff goes sideways or whatever. I had seen dudes get jumped before and knew what that looked like before it happened.
Yeah.
Like I had seen stuff go really sideways and I don't want to act like I was like from the mean streets. It wasn't like that, but I've been in places where stuff could get interesting. And so I always keep my head on a swivel because I want to know what's happening around me. I want to be able to see it before it happens. I have a habit of watching people when they don't know I'm watching them because you learn a lot about folks based on facial expressions, and body language, and all that.
And why you're watching them, right? You know, that's another thing. And it's so interesting. I had an experience of my own living in New Jersey, living in Cherry Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I never forget, I just found it like a little, I guess unforgiving is the word in a lot of respects. I found it really hard to make connections.
Yep.
Like, you know, like I remember meeting, there was a brother in the apartment complex that I lived in. I met this brother and, you know, I'm gonna go play some ball, right? And he's got this brother that played ball at, you know, University of Denver. And struck up a little bit of a relationship, got to know him a little bit, but it was always a little, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't like, you know, he was like really trying to hang out, but we go play ball and it was like, that was about it. And it was just interesting that I couldn't figure out the arm's length piece.
Right.
And that gives me some real insight into that, you know? And it's just, that was a real, it was only a short period of time. I think I was in New Jersey for like 6 months, but I felt that this is a different place.
Yeah, but Cherry Hill may identify more so with Philly.
Because it's South Jersey.
You may be picking up on some of that too. Yeah. But Philly's got its own.
It's got,
lived there too. Yeah, it's got its own.
My sister was there. Culture. It does have its own culture.
So listen, brother, you've done a lot of wonderful things, man. And as you think about this part of your career history, what are the highlights for you? Because you've obviously done some wonderful things. Are there certain things in your career that really stick out and you find to be the impetus of what got you here today?
You know, the interesting thing for me is that I started off as this kid who had everything kind of planned out. You know, I knew in seventh grade I was going to move from New Jersey to North Carolina to get in state residency, and then I was going to go to Chapel Hill, and I was going to go someplace more prestigious for law school. Like, all that was planned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to the law firm and decided, and loved it, but decided to leave it to go in-house at AOL Time Warner. From that point on, I have let the path find me.
Got it.
Right? I haven't tried to say, and people always ask you, well, what's your dream job? Like, what's the thing that you really want? And they expect me to say something like, I want to be the commissioner of the NFL, or, you know, and I'm just, I don't think that way anymore. What I want is to make certain that I can be in places where I can be successful. Where the talent, skills, abilities, experiences that I have, the temperament that I have is going to be accepted. It's going to be a platform where we can do big and ambitious things as a team. You know, and I want to work with good people, you know, who operate with integrity and respect for each other. So you know, the things I think I'm most proud of in my career are I've done a lot of repositioning, building, starting from scratch, that kind of stuff. It's a great thing about this job. It's mature and developed as an organization, mm-hmm. and I don't have to come in and build the plane while I'm flying it. The plane is built, got seats, people like it, all that stuff. I'm going to be doing tinkering around the edges and figuring out how to innovate, how to be creative, mm-hmm. and how to make what's already good better, and then find whatever deficiencies there may be or areas where we're not getting the best out of what we have and make those better, kind of level those up. I was the first director of the D.C. Department of Small and Local Business Development. So I was the chief advocate for small business in the mm-hmm. nation's capital. It had been a small office before I came in and worked with a council member who happens to be our frat brother, too, and turned it into a mayoral level cabinet position. And then I went and ran it. I was helping good people who were business folks, hardworking, to find resources, access to capital, information, contracting, how to figure out how to do more business with their government that they're already paying taxes to, how to work with larger businesses and joint venture opportunities and things of that nature. It was like super, super rewarding work, right? Because I had just come out of a failed entrepreneurial thing myself mm-hmm. with my top 10 law degree and my two, Kwame and Dave, my two Wall Street banker, you know, partners and all that. And we couldn't figure out how to make it work. But you got a guy who's a contractor or a plumber or electrician or runs a masonry company or what have you, who's been at it for 20 years and just fighting and scratching and trying to figure out how to get over the hump. And we were in a position to help people do that. So that was probably some of the most rewarding work I ever did in my life. But getting into sports has been great, man. Sports is, to me, sports is special because it has a unique and uncanny ability to build bridges between people and communities and sometimes even nations, if we're mm-hmm. talking about on a world stage, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you hear about how in these conflict zones around the world, when the World Cup's on, the fighting stops, mm-hmm. right? Like, what else can do that? And so being able to work in an environment where you can have that kind of meaningful impact on people's lives, you make them smile, get us all on the same team. You and I might not, you know, you might wear red and I might wear blue. We might not ever talk to each other if we saw each other on the street, but if we go see the Lakers play, we're on the same team for 2 hours, mm-hmm. rooting for Kobe, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's a special, mm-hmm. that's a special thing. And I've seen that most recently in NASCAR, mm-hmm. you know, where folks who might not otherwise acknowledge each other on the street,
especially
are in there rooting for Chase Elliott or rooting for Kevin Harvick or Bubba Wallace or whoever it is. And that's special. And to take that a step farther, the reason this opportunity at the Fiesta Bowl organization is so interesting is because not only do we get to do that, but then because they give away, I should say we, give away $3 to $5 million a year to mm-hmm. charities throughout the state of Arizona, you get to connect that hard work with good works in the mm-hmm. community with an obvious and direct through line. Where else do you get to do that? Right? Most of us do things for a vocation where we're pushing paper and making people money and hopefully making ourselves a little bit of money. But making real impact, given scores of teachers checks for $2,500 so they can have other things in their classroom for their students to learn, doing stuff for other, you know, nonprofits in and around the state that helps make a real big difference in the lives of young people. This is perfect.
That was great, man.
That's incredible, man. You know, the only thing I, you know, would challenge you on in any of that is that I know you mentioned that, you know, beyond the law firm, most things found you. I don't know if that's in my view, if I'm like on the outside looking out to the world that you were able to create for yourself. I don't know that I would say that's probably the answer, only because I would assume you didn't just go into the law firm and go into that office right. and like close the door and put your head down and just do the work. You immersed yourself into the community so that people were aware that you existed, right? That you existed, that you had something that you could contribute for the greater good.
Right.
And people saw that. And in those things, people think, wait a minute, this guy's a leader. He's got some, you know, there's the quality that people take in and say, he can do more. We can use him somewhere to help benefit this cause or that cause. And I think that's when those things, to your point about they find you because of your actions and the activities that you've decided, you know what? instead of just going home and, you know, popping up, you know, bottle of red wine and watching the Wizards play tonight, I'm going to go out probably when I don't feel like it and go to this neighborhood event or go to this community event and try to get involved and try to connect the resources and the skills and experience that I have to the greater good of what needs to happen in this town and make life better for people.
Now, this is what happens when you interview with your good friends who've known you for 30 years, right? This is what they basically say is, maybe you want to restate that, sir. and I appreciate you. So what I did not mean to suggest was that I was not strategic in the way that I've pursued my career. I have been strategic in everything that I've done. What I did mean to suggest was I wasn't as specific as to say, I want to go to this company right. and do this thing, and then that company in this role. I was more open-minded and flexible about where that might be as long as it had certain hallmarks of an opportunity. But I'm always strategic, always doing exactly what you said. I remember being at AOL as a young lawyer. I'm still probably, I don't know, fifth or sixth year, you know, practicing law. And I remember thinking, because we're in Washington, D.C., right? So there's a lot of big P and small P politics there. And I remember saying to myself, you have to raise your profile. Mm-hmm. You got to start getting involved in political campaigns. You got to start doing stuff in the community in a way that mm-hmm. people know who you are. Because to your point, sitting in an office and even doing fantastic work is not going to get you into the rooms, the places and spaces that you want to occupy in the future if people don't know who you are. And so you need to get out there in a way that allows folks that do what you do, but that do other things, to know who you are, what you're capable of, et cetera. And so I was very strategic and intentional about doing those things. And that has been the way I've kind of lived my life personally and professionally.
And I think you have to, right? Because, you know, you have to be strategic about those things. I know DJ and I talk a lot about, you know, some of the formative years in our careers in terms of what we were trying to accomplish and to build. And a lot of times it's about showing up. And yep. I don't know that you can't downplay how important it is to just step into a room sometimes and make people aware that you exist,
yep.
you know, and obviously in a really constructive way, a positive way, to be able to be a part of, you know, the good work as opposed to being a distraction to something. But more or less, it's really about how do we, particularly as Black men, involve ourselves in a way where people don't look at it as, okay, what does he want? Well, more or less, what can he contribute?
Yeah.
Which is what we need more of.
I gave a talk yesterday to some business and legal students at Vanderbilt via Zoom, and they asked me a question about dealing with being in places and feeling imposter syndrome. And I said, I haven't ever felt imposter syndrome in my life, and nor should you. Like, because an imposter means you're not capable, talented, or worthy of opportunity, which is not the case for any of the people who I was talking to, and it's definitely not the case for me. You may have knowledge deficiencies. You may have experience deficiencies, but those can be made up for, right? That gap can be closed. Being an imposter is a phony. It's somebody who's not supposed to be in that place. I have never, ever, 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 ever felt that in any mm-hmm. place that I have ever been in, nor will I ever occupy a space where I feel that. And so I think you're right. You have to do those things, but there has to be, and God knows I'm trying to make certain my kids feel this, but we, especially as men of color, have to have an abiding confidence. If you don't have that armor, it's real hard to get through this and to do the things that you want to do if you don't have that armor that says, no matter how I get treated, no matter what somebody tells me, no matter how long it takes me to get the thing I want, no matter what obstacles are put in my place and all that kind of stuff, I'm worthy. Mm-hmm. And I can have that. And I may have to take a little longer road. I may have to encounter some obstacles that other folks didn't have to. But I'm worthy of that thing and I'm going to get it because I believe in me, mm-hmm. the innate goodness of me mm-hmm. and my capabilities, right? So I don't let anybody make me feel like an imposter anywhere. It's never happened. I was like, that's foreign. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, nobody's going to give you that armor. I mean, you know, we have to put that on every day to your mm-hmm. point. And, you know, the biggest sort of aha for me, I never forget when I joined YPO, Young Presidents Organization, and, you know, young entrepreneur building a business and having some success. And, you know, I get into this room. This is like 16, 17 years ago. I'm in my late 30s. And I get into this room and, you know, I'm the, you know, talking about first. We talked about first with
Carl
a little earlier. And I'm like the first African-American in the YPO chapter here in Arizona. And, you know, I'm in this group and I'm going to these meetings. I'm used to being the first one in the room in a lot of instances, unfortunately, for how we all grew up in a lot of respects. But I got into my forum group and I got these, you know, it's like this group of 10 really successful men, all white men, different fields and, you know, all CEOs. And my first inclination in the room was like, wow, like, okay, I got a lot to learn. I'm going to learn a lot here. It wasn't intimidating necessarily, right. But I'm coming in it from a perspective of I've got a lot to learn from these seasoned, esteemed people until I got to sit there for 3 or 4 meetings and realize how fucked up they were, you know, in a lot of respects, right? And so in terms of they didn't really have their shit together all the time and that how they got there was not perhaps the same route that I got there. Sometimes it's nepotism, sometimes it's the pile of cash that dad left behind or whatever the case may be. And I'm not disparaging people because there are a lot of hardworking people, a lot of hardworking white men were successful because they pulled themselves up, you know, never went to college, whatever the case may be, and really made something of themselves. But at the same time, it gave me the perspective of, wait a minute, I bring and contribute a lot to this room, and my experiences and my knowledge is just as on par, if not above, what I get exposed to when I'm here. I'm teaching a lot of times as much as I'm receiving and learning. And so it gives you that validation about who you are and what you contribute and what you bring that is irreplaceable in some respects because you carry that with you all the time.
Yeah, very much so.
And you got to be okay with not knowing stuff. Like, I'm not, I don't feel like I have to pretend like I know everything. You know, like maybe it has to do with this age.
No, I think a lot of it is age
too. But I'm probably in my 30s. You know, maybe I would have puffed my chest out more.
Yeah, he. You know, when he said that, I was so like because I thought
prior guest talked about being ignorant.
Exactly,
and that's when he felt like he was flourishing.
It's freeing.
Yeah,
because you don't have to pretend like you know everything, right?
But it's not about knowing everything. It never is. That's not it.
Never is. Why is that even an expectation?
And then what? Let's say you do. Then what? Is that success? No, it's not.
And some of that, I think, with us. Tends to be part of the barrier or the story, the fable we are told about why we can't have, why we can't be. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't know enough. You haven't done enough. You haven't experienced. Where, to your point earlier, our counterparts have often learned on the job, either because they had to or because they were afforded that opportunity to start something at a younger age before you had the experiences that would match the stature in a company or something like that. And so it's not unheard of. And we should, you know, hopefully feel comfortable learning on the job as well. But come to it with an open mind and an open heart in a way that allows you to learn from other folks. Now, that's what I worry about with this younger generation. And not to sound like the old man, it's like, get off my lawn, kids. But more and more I sound that way. It's like, you know, you can't think you know every damn thing.
Well, and that's the key, too, because I watched my daughter in the same regard. You know, it's hard to tell her anything right now. You know, because, you know, she's in an elite boarding school and de facto I know everything and mom and dad know nothing. Yeah,
what do
now.
You know? Right.
Exactly. What do you know?
Yeah.
And we're so uneducated in a lot of respects. It's just interesting to see, you know, and, you know, I don't know if it's just the phase of, you know, that period in life, but, or if is this a generational thing where there's just something that they're not willing to take in as opposed to what they can learn and who they can learn it from.
And some of it is an attempt for them to form their own self-identity.
Indeed,
for sure. Some of it is that. So
for
sure. You watch that.
For sure.
So we talked about how sport has impacted your life today and how you've impacted sport today. Growing up, what role did sport play for you?
Not as big a role as I would have liked it to if I was more talented. I was pretty active kid, so I was always playing. I played baseball, football, and basketball. Baseball all the way through senior year of high school. Basketball probably up until about ninth grade where, you know, other people kept growing and I didn't. And football through ninth grade as well, same thing. When, you know, when guys got you know, over 200 pounds and enjoyed going head on in those drills that we used to do before we knew about concussions and all and CTE. I went, yeah, check please. I don't need to be doing that. So, but as much as I liked playing and as much as I liked watching as a spectator, I was always interested in the business of sports. I always wanted to know how deals got done, whether that was a collective bargaining agreement between a players union and the league, whether it was an endorsement deal, whether it was a deal an agent signs with a player, whether it was a partnership. You know, I wanted to know how those deals got done. I wanted to pull that curtain back and see what was behind there. And so that has been kind of the motivating force for me throughout my career is wanting to know about deals, wanting to do deals, and wanting to do them in this particular space. And it wasn't lost on me that sports and entertainment are a space that people that look like us tend to have some more leverage than we do in other spaces, like, say, technology or real estate or industry or things of that nature. And so I thought, okay, well, there's probably an opportunity for not only for me to be involved, but for me to be able to make some meaningful relationships and to be able to get some opportunities to show what I can do and how I go about doing it. So it's been great.
Yeah, it's a whole lot more fun than selling trash companies, which is what I did when I was a young M&A attorney. But I think those formative years, particularly when you're talking about transactions, deals, and understanding the inner workings of those things, obviously very transferable to sports and how you can leverage all of that.
So growing up, what was your family circle like? Brothers and sisters? You have both parents growing up. What was that like?
So parents, biological parents, divorced when I was like two. Raised by stepfather. He married my mom when I was probably five or six. Had my sister, probably married mom when I was five. Had my sister when I was six, almost seven. So I have a younger sister. Who, as I like to say, is a hard act to precede. She's a freaking rock star. Makes me look bad every day of the week.
That's good.
The only thing I got going for me is I was born first, you know. So it's just the two of us. And like I said, grew up in Central New Jersey, had the good fortune to be raised by a stepfather who I never call step. I mean, he's my dad.
That's beautiful.
He did a thing that a lot of people don't want to do. You raise another man's son like your own. And he did that. I never felt like we weren't family. I remember my grandmother when I moved in with her in North Carolina telling me one time, I was fighting with him about something because I was a teenager and that's what we do. She was like, you know, sometimes he acts like you're his child as much, if not more, than your sister, who is his biological child. And I remember that like stopped me in my tracks because that wasn't a perspective I had ever considered. Because, you know, you're a teenager with your dad. You feel like, you know, they come by your room, you're in the bed, they knock on the door, get out of the bed, want to do something. And the funny thing about that, the ironic thing, and y'all will know what I'm talking about, is I hear his voice coming out of my mouth all the time. Yeah. All the time.
Do you hear your mom in the background going, leave that boy alone?
You know you need to get out of bed.
He's going to keep knocking on your door until you get up. But now I know why he wanted me to get up. Like, get up and go do something.
Rake
like,
those
life
leaves,
is going by.
Cut that grass.
Absolutely.
Get after it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that sleeping in on Saturday morning was not the thing, man. He was like, get up.
Yeah, let's be productive.
Yeah,
let's
get up, get out.
I cut my kids a little bit of slack because that's my 16-year-old likes to remind me. I'm a growing boy. Like, I need 12 to 14 hours of sleep. Okay.
A week.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a lot smarter than we were.
Oh, he's so much smarter.
I didn't have that argument formulated.
So much smarter than I was, that's for sure. So the family was stable. I come from a family, thankfully, of, you know, where education was not only an expectation, but it was also something that was highly valued. My mom's parents, both her mother and father, had master's degrees. Mm-hmm. My grandfather got a master's at NYU, like probably in the 40s or 50s or something unbelievable like that, pledged at your chapter.
Good man.
And so, you know, we knew what was expected of us.
Absolutely.
That's why when people say to me, oh, being the first black NASCAR track president or now being the first black executive director of the Fiesta Bowl, like, does that put more pressure on you? And I'm like, no. there's already pressure on me all the time. It's self-induced pressure because mm-hmm. the expectations of my family and the people I hang around and the folks that I am around, achievement is expected. It's expected. It's required. It doesn't mean that you lose value if you're not kind of, you know, doing things to the nth degree all the time, but it's expected. And so I have that pressure on myself. What I want to do in these positions is to be an example for folks, to be example for young people who may have thought about careers in these places and wanting to do these things, but not seen enough folks who look like them, mm-hmm. who come from where they come from doing them to really feel like it's achievable. If I can help in that, then that's certainly worthwhile, but it's no additional pressure.
I think that's interesting too, because I think there's this, I don't know if perception is the right word, but I think people miss the notion that you come from a lineage that none of this was like surprising in terms of where you were headed and what was before you to try to accomplish or be a part of. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's funny you said that, you know, my great aunt in North Carolina, small town, probably not more than 200 people. Got an undergraduate degree from Columbia and her master's at NYU. This is in the 1930s. My maternal grandfather, PhD, was a professor at Johnson C. Smith.
Yep.
You know, till he retired, you know, educator. Mm-hmm. And we have those histories before us. Yeah. You know, again, the idea of going to not just college, but graduate school. Both my parents have master's degrees, right? Those were things that were, those were milestones that were just a part of what you were not necessarily expected to do, but you in your mind knew, well, damn, if my parents did that, or my grandparents did that, or my great aunt did, like, what am I going to do?
Right.
And so it follows you to sort of proceed into those footsteps and try to make good.
Yep.
It does. What I will say, though, is that I do love to see brothers like you, Eric, and brothers like you, Charles, who also are okay giving yourselves credit, because none of that's automatic.
Right.
Just because we also know some of the hurdles that are put in front of us.
You got to earn those degrees.
Yeah, you got to earn all that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to. I'm going to ask you this question with a bit of an assumption in it, and you can just say, hey, I've never felt that way. If and when do you recall the moment it hit you as an executive or a rising executive that, you know what? I don't have to be perfect for anybody.
You know, I can't remember a specific time. I think like anything else, it's about the reps, right? And it's about feeling more and more comfortable. It's like Charles's experience at YPO. The more you start talking with people and realizing that they struggle with some of the same things you mm-hmm. struggle with, they have problems that they're trying to solve that they haven't quite figured out yet. There's stuff they don't know. There's some stuff they don't know that you do know and you know better. I mean, you just start to see yourself as a peer and as someone of comparable ability. And I think once you feel that and you see the potential deficiencies or lack of perfection in others, then you go, oh, well, I'm kind of like everybody else. Like, I don't have to, even though we talk in our community about holding ourselves or being held to mm-hmm. a higher standard, mm-hmm. which I think still exists in many quarters. We don't have to be, the standard ain't perfection. Mm-hmm. It's not perfection. So now I have felt the pressure of expectation for success. I tell a story about when I was at the XFL. So my team's game was the first game of this new league, first season, all that. We were the week after the Super Bowl, ABC, prime time, like 2:00 in the afternoon. This was the commercial for this new league.
League, yeah.
And about a month before our first game, ticket sales were not where they needed to be. And I remember being on a phone call with the president of the league and a bunch of the ticketing folks and other people and myself and them saying, what's the problem? Like, stadium's got to be full because people are going to turn that on. They're going to be curious about what we're doing and what the game is like and what the level of play is and all that. And if they see an empty stadium, a soccer stadium, mind you, that only could fit 18,000 people, if they see an empty stadium, that could do us in. And rarely have I felt sick to my stomach in a work environment. I literally almost had to get off the phone. I felt so sick because I didn't know I was doing, I thought, everything that we could do in order to move the needle.
Yeah.
And what really happened was, and this comes with confidence, I finally had to say, we need more resources, right? Like we needed a bigger megaphone. We needed TV. We needed radio. Like we needed traditional big time media to help move the needle on that stuff. Me trying to do 100 speeches in 100 days and hand-to-hand combat was not going, that was going to sell dozens of tickets. It wasn't going to sell hundreds or thousands of them, right? So having that confidence to be able to say, okay, I'm doing what can reasonably be expected of me. Now I need you to help me if reaching that goal is what is important to you. And you had the confidence that I could do it by hiring me, then give me the support that I need in order to do it. Thankfully, they did. It was a huge success. Sold the game out. Looked great on television. The league was off and running until the pandemic decided that, nope, you're done halfway through the season.
Do you think there's a – because obviously the second iteration, the next iteration actually of the league is coming up, I guess, in the spring again.
Yes,
next year. With The Rock being, I guess – part of the ownership group. What do you think it's going to take to make that a different outcome? Obviously, the pandemic had a lot to do with this one, but what do you think they need to do to be successful this time around?
I think they've done some of it. They've moved out of some markets that I think were excessively expensive, out of some buildings that were too big, into markets where I think they can have more support and be more successful faster.
From a team perspective?
Yeah. There was no reason for us to have a New York team playing
competing MetLife,
I guess.
Yeah, MetLife. Yeah.
80,000. There's just no reason for it, right? So I think they made those adjustments. You know, three bites at the same apple is a tough one. It's a tough one. The business case is smart. America's favorite sport by far is football, football.
For sure.
Give people professional football at a decent quality when there is none to consume. Week after the Super Bowl in February through the end of April, right? Fox just launched the USFL last year.
Yeah.
They're bringing that back.
Mm-hmm.
They did all their games in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the Birmingham team was playing, there was nobody in the stands. I mean, nobody. I didn't know if the janitors were in the stands. But people love football. And so if you can give it to them at a decent quality with some names that people know, like my quarterback was Cardale Jones from Ohio State, won the first BCS national championship, I think out here, in fact, certainly played in the Fiesta Bowl. And so we had some stuff that we could work with. The rules were better. They made the game safer, faster, and I think more exciting. So they're on to something. If they can get the marketplace to give them a chance, I think it can catch on. I think it could catch on. Now, I don't think there's room for two spring football leagues.
Right.
So that'll have to merge at some point or so. I don't think there's enough folks who are going to go, yeah, I spend my weekend watching both of y'all. Like, that's not a real thing. But I think it can work. I think they have to be cost conscious. You know, Vince McMahon was saying he had, $500 million he was willing to spend to give us a 3 to 5 year runway. You know, had great television deals with Disney, ABC, ESPN, and Fox. So it was there, man. It was there, and it was happening. Like, I felt it. It was happening. And we had kind of it wasn't as irreverent a brand of football as the first iteration of the XFL was, which really was them trying to bring wrestling to the football field. And people sniffed that out and went, that's inauthentic, and it feels hokey, and we don't want that. We want real football. Just with some changes around the edges. And so if they can capture that cost containment, and if folks, give them a chance, it could work. It could work. And I hope they do well. I'd love to see The Rock and Danny Garcia and do well. And I still have friends there working at the league. So I'd love for them to be successful.
Yeah, we'll check it out for sure. What are you most excited about being here in Phoenix in this new job?
being on the show every week.
We can make that happen. We can absolutely make that happen. That's the easy
what
one.
You asked for, Eric. Right there.
I hope you had higher aspirations than that.
Wow. What do you think about three hosts?
What I said earlier, I mean, being able to have the kind of significant and meaningful impact on this community and communities across the state of Arizona from the good work that we do is something I'm very passionate about. Getting to know new people in a new marketplace, you know? I mean, I'm thankful I already have friends here and folks who are accomplished and know people that can help me kind of get a running start. That's always important. The hardest thing about this is leaving Nashville, a place that embraced me fully, very quickly. Yeah, that is literally very difficult to leave because, you know, I got folks I've met in 2 years that are family now. And I pray, knock on wood and cross my fingers, that I can recreate that here because that was... Whatever success I was able to have in Nashville, a big part of it was because I was embraced in that way, personally and professionally, in that marketplace. And so I pray that Phoenix will do the same.
Well, I got to tell you, we're excited to have you. And, you know, I think, you know, DJ and I both, you know, are excited to have an ally in this community because we care about what happens, particularly young people. Education is one of the big things that I'm involved in. DJs have been a huge supporter of the school that I'm involved in. And we know that education is the pathway for opportunity. It's been that way, I think, for all three of us could count that as part of, you know, our journeys that have helped us to reach a certain level of success. And you being here in this community, being a part of that work and what you're doing that gives back and connects to young people and the opportunities to get a better education, it's certainly priceless, and we're excited to be alongside you here.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Congratulations again.
Thanks,
man. That's huge.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. Feels good. Feels good.
All right. Well,
now I got to go find a place to live.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. Well, at least real estate prices are falling. But we appreciate having you, Eric. Good to see you. We'll be doing this a lot. And thank you for joining us.
Cool.
The Conscious Vibe.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
And check us out on tcvpodcast.com.